welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet direct to your earbuds. And today I have a guest that I can't wait to talk to. His name is Dale Ahlquist, and he wrote this book. It is a compilation of G.K. Chesterton quotes. And then he adds his own magic to the book as well. When my son first gave me this book, I thought, you know what? I'm not going to read this book. I've read Chesterton. I love Chesterton, but I'm not going to read a book of Chesterton quotes. I opened it up and I started reading it and I couldn't stop. And since that, I think I've read it three times. My normal habit, and I think this is a good habit for people to get into, you know, C.S. Lewis used to say that you don't really read a book, at least a book of substantial value, you don't really read it until you've read it three times. And the way I go through a book, I skim through it first, then I read it with a pentel, underlining, and then I read it again with a highlighter. And by the time I've gone through with a highlighter, I have the gist of the book. And then I take the time to memorize some of the quotes. G.K. Chesterton is eminently quotable. And we'll learn a little bit from Dale about G.K. Chesterton. But I want to say a few more things about this book because I would love for all of you to have a copy of this book and then to read it and reread it and reread it again. Because the wisdom that is proffered by Chesterton can help all of us in the 21st century. The book is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org, or you can write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Now, let me just read a couple of endorsements from the back of this book. I won't read the whole endorsements, but here's one by Christopher Check. He says, mankind's future depends on whether we embrace or reject the wisdom of this book. I mean, that's quite an endorsement. Then he goes on to say, you better read this book before doing so becomes a criminal act. Here's another endorsement that I love. This book is exactly what the doctor ordered for a society that has lost its mind when it comes to defining the family and the sexes. And then one more. By the way, that was Lewis Marcos. Robert Riley, he says that this book is assembled so brilliantly by Ahlquist. This Chesterton book does with rapier wit and robust humor what so few could do. It makes laughing stock of those sappers who are so earnestly undermining the family in the name of freedom. The woke should fear this book. Everyone else should get it. And again, you get your copy on the web at equip.org, or when you write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Well, Dale, the editor and the author, the compiler of this book, is president of the Society of Gilbert Keith Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton. There's a lot I could say about him. He's the author of many books, and he's been called probably the greatest living authority on the life and work of G.K. Chesterton. He is a senior fellow of the Chesterton Library at London, and I am absolutely delighted that we get to spend this time with you, Dale. Thanks for being on the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Hank. It's a great pleasure to be with you. God bless you.
Yeah, since this is video as well, some will be listening just audio, but since it's video, you have a very interesting backdrop.
I was hoping that you would notice it there, Hank. Your background is not interesting at all, but I'm sitting in the costume department of Chesterton Academy in Minneapolis, Minnesota, suburb of Hopkins, and this is a place of fantasy in here. It looks like the old curiosity shop. You have just wonderful artifacts of all kinds hanging on the walls and costumes on racks and in bins. And behind me are three mannequin heads with very interesting wigs on them. So I'm trying to find a way to get ahead, and this is how I'm doing it.
Well, you succeeded. You know, the title of this book is worth the price of the book itself, I think. I mean, it's a very simple title, The Story of the Family, but the subtitle is incredible because here you have G.K. Chesterton on the only state that creates and loves its own citizens. What an incredible definition of the family.
Yeah, that's, of course, from Chesterton. That's the line of Chesterton's, and I was looking for, you know, something that would really grab people's attention. But what an interesting definition. That just puts everything into perspective. What you do when you start a family, you create a state. It's a little kingdom is what it is. And it's the only state, as he says, that creates and loves its own citizens. There's no better way for children to come into the world, to be raised in the world, than with two loving parents. And that is this very simple universal concept that is for some reason under attack today.
Yeah, so I think when I'm presented with a book on the family, your first instinct is to say, I know about the family. I mean, what is Chesterton going to tell me about the family? And yet, reading through this book, and as I said, I've done it three times, you learn that the family is the basic bedrock of all of civilization. You can destroy civilizations, but ultimately you can't destroy the family, because if you destroy the family, civilization can't exist.
Right. And obviously a civilization in which the family is weak is a weak civilization. If the family is suffering in a society, that's why the whole society is suffering. It's a very simple equation, and we are experiencing it firsthand. Chesterton, amazingly, was writing about it 100 years ago as if he were writing about it today.
Yeah, so I want to find out why you are so fascinated with G.K. Chesterton.
Well, Chesterton grabbed me. I did not pursue him. He found me. And you mentioned C.S. Lewis, Hank, and it was because of reading C.S. Lewis that I discovered Chesterton. At a certain point, when you find an author to be to your liking, you want to know what is behind that author. And Chesterton really is the great inspiration for C.S. Lewis. And so many of C.S. Lewis's basic ideas are simply embellishments of things from G.K. Chesterton. And when I started reading Chesterton, it was really instantaneous that he grabbed a hold of me. I started with the book that was so influential on C.S. Lewis, on his own conversion to Christianity, which is The Everlasting Man. C.S. Lewis was an atheist when he started reading the book, and his life had changed by the time he finished reading the book, The Everlasting Man. And Lewis said very pithily, a young man who's serious about his atheism cannot be too careful about what he reads. And when I read that book, I had discovered someone who put it all together. I was used to reading, you know, good, heavy intellectual stuff, but it was always really quite focused and quite narrow, frankly. And Chesterton brings it all together. In that book, he writes about history and culture and tradition, also mythology and literature and philosophy and theology. It's everything you can think of that you need to tell the whole story of the world. And how it all converges when Christ steps onto the stage.
So you talked a little bit about the magic in reading, and we live in a culture that has lost the art of reading. I was just reading a statistic about my own home country. I was born in Holland, in the Netherlands, and the vast majority of people in Holland do not read the Bible. But I think the further problem is that people do not read at all anymore. We're so addicted to social media that we can't really sit with a good book and ponder its profundities.
That's very true. And interestingly enough, Chesterton somehow manages to work in the modern reader because of those short quotes. You know, he's got a way of encapsulating a great truth in 26 words or less. He can do it. And yet, the quotations, which make up a part of this book, are then, you know, expanded into paragraphs and even whole essays. And so the great sentence, the great one-liner of Chesterton can grab you and pull you in, And then he has you at that point. Then you want to go deeper right away. But you're absolutely right about people with their short attention spans and their weakness to be completely dazzled by shiny objects and getting them to turn away from contemplating the written word. And yet Chesterton seems to be a great solution to that, a great antidote to that problem.
Well, let me read one of the quotes that you may be alluding to. That's an epigraph in the book, where Chesterton says, "You can free things from alien or accidental laws, but not from the laws of their own nature. You may, if you like, free a tiger from his bars, but do not free him from his stripes. Do not free a camel of the burden of his hump. You may be freeing him from being a camel. Do not go about as a demagogue, encouraging triangles to break out of the prison of their three sides. If a triangle breaks out of its three sides, it comes, in terms of its life, to a lamentable end."
Yeah, that's from my opening essay, is defending the triangle. When we defend the family, we're defending the triangle. If you free the family out of its triangle, the family comes to an end.
Yeah, you know, and you said this earlier on as we began this podcast, but this is the essence. We have tried to free the triangle of its three sides. In one of my books, my latest book, I quote a book titled Same-Sex Marriage, in which the authors forward the notion that marriage has at all times and in all societies been a relationship between men and women, that marriage exists because of the dual gender distinct nature of humanity. As such, the connection between marriage and procreation is more than just incidental. But in a contrary opinion, you have Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, who holds that marriage as historically defined fosters little more than ill will and animosity. In his considered opinion, I write, "Anyone who embraces the historical definition of marriage, thus excluding same-sex couples, does so out of hate and animus." Actually, this is a paraphrase of what the justice said.
Well, one of Chesterton's great quotes, I think it's in the book, is when Noah was entering the ark, he took two of everything, but he didn't take two Noahs. And similarly, he says that the lily, which was the symbol, by the way, of Oscar Wilde in the gay 90s, the lily was their symbol. He says the lily is beautiful, but its purpose is not to be beautiful. Its purpose is to make more lilies. And there's Chesterton, as poetically and as succinctly as possible, criticizing the homosexual movement of his own day that he lived through, and yet doing it in a very subtle and not, you know, he's not pounding anyone over the head. He's just making you think of what the basic truth of what's behind beauty. It's a creative force is what it is. It's a creative force.
And that triangle that we're talking about is a triangle not only of father, mother, and child, but of child, mother, and father. There's a mystical mirror that we can look at and see the image of the triadic one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's another great point of Chesterton's in this.
Chesterton also said that there's nothing in any other social relations in any way parallel to the mutual attraction of the sexes. And by missing that point, the modern world has fallen into 100 follies. It seems a simple point, but this is the essence of the matter.
Yeah, and the follies that we've fallen into are legion, of course, and we just keep finding new follies is what we do because of ignoring this basic truth. But as Chesterton says, you know, fallacies do not cease to be fallacies just because they become fashionable.
That's right. And if you give up this basic truth, if you give up the three sides of the triangle, there's something always to supplant the truth. It's an error if you don't have control within that nucleus, you have control within another nucleus, and that nucleus is quite self-evidently the state.
Right, right. He says the state is the only thing powerful enough to sweep in and replace the role of the family, because it has to be something powerful, because the family is such an important unit, the formation of a child and the role of parents. He says only the state has the power to do it if the parents do not, or if, sadly, if the parents relinquish that power. And his insight into the growth of the state influence in our lives, it's intensely prophetic. You know, he says that the state never had as much power in all of human history as it does now when it can send a child to the public school. That's an astonishing insight. We think of public education as something that is one of the great developments of the modern world. And there's many good things about it, of course. But if the state controls it, you have given your child at the most formative period of their lives into the hands of the government to help form their minds. And you've taken that power and that influence away from the parents. And the traditional way of looking at the school was that the teacher was in loco parentis, really with the parents' permission and cooperation, standing in the place of the parent for part of the day to teach the child, a sacred responsibility, and working in cooperation, representing the parent. But with the modern state education, the teacher no longer represents the parent, but on the contrary, is teaching things absolutely contrary to what a parent would teach their own children. They've driven a wedge between child and parent that did not exist before.
I want to expand on that, but not right at this moment. I want to get into that, because this is a profound point and a seminal part of the book. Chesterton knew that the generation that breaks free from the family ultimately finds itself in chains. But that in itself is a profound statement, and it's absolutely true. I mean, it's a maxim that you cannot undermine.
It's one of Chesterton's great paradoxes. He always is pointing it out, that freedom exists within the rules, freedom exists within the boundaries. It's a great image from his book, Orthodoxy, that he says, you know, the church doctrine may seem like walls, but they are the walls of a playground. And there's great freedom within the walls. And if you remove the walls, he says, it's as if you have removed the walls of a playground that's on a cliff, and the children cannot play anymore because they're afraid of destruction is what they're afraid of. The walls have been keeping them safe the whole time. And the family is the same thing. The family not only creates safety, but it creates freedom. The place of liberty is the home. It's one of Chesterton's great arguments. And as you said, as you quoted, you break out of that freedom, you will find yourself in chains.
Yeah. Chesterton says the most dangerous criminal now is the entirely lawless modern philosopher. I love that quote. He also augments that by talking about a triple homicide. So the war on the family begins with an attack on marriage, then on the Marriage Act, then on children, and not just killing children in the womb, but killing the innocence of the child without killing the child and killing the soul of the child through an education system that has banished God. That bears elaboration.
Yeah, well, that's kind of explains the whole layout of the book. We talk about the first, the importance of the family itself, of marriage, when marriage is attacked, and through easy divorce, Chesterton argued, you will obviously, effective frivolous divorce will be frivolous marriage. If the father and mother do not maintain the dignity and fortitude of the vow, you know, that's what breaks up families. That's what, how families first are broken up. But what leads to that is interfering with the Marriage Act. And, you know, the right place for sex, this mysterious and beautiful thing, is within marriage. If it's outside of marriage, it becomes a less than sacred act, because it's going to be interfering with the process of life itself. And when you start interfering with life, then you start doing war on life. And, you know, either you are defending it or you will be attacking it. You'll become the champion against it. Again, his prophetic insight. This is in, you know, writing about this in the 1920s. You know, long before the advent of the acceptance of contraception, it was already being discussed then. And he said, the effect of contraception will be abortion, but it will also be sexual perversion. It'll be divorce. It will be objectifying women and treating women with disrespect because we've lost the right use of sex. He says, the moment that sex ceases to be a servant, it becomes a tyrant. And we are living under that tyranny right now, the tyranny of sex.
Yeah, indeed. And something that we'll expand on a little later on in the podcast. But something I want to get to right now, Dale, is something that I found very interesting in the book, where G.K. Chesterton says that the wage system, read capitalism, has played an outsized role in breaking up the family. Now, that seems like a very controversial remark at first blush. I mean, you think, what do you want, socialism? You know, I mean, I believe in Christian capitalism, responsibility associated with wealth. So I start reading that, and I read that with consternation at the very beginning. But then as I made my way through the material, it started making sense, because in one way, capitalism is taking you out of the very role that you were designed for. So you end up working for a conglomerate or an organization instead of working for the family, which is your primary duty. And as Chesterton points out, the man may be the head of the house, but the woman is the heart of the house. What she brings to the table in educating children cannot be replaced by a nanny, by a school, by the state, or by anything else.
Yeah, and just as he objected to women being taken out of the home, he objected really to men being taken out of the home. The idea that the craftsmanship of the father, the skill of the father, is in service of the family and not in service of someone else, really. And his criticisms of big government are equally applied to big business. There's little difference between someone sitting at a desk in a large office building, if it's owned by a corporation or if it's a government agency. It's really the same effect. You're being a wage earner, and you are, as Chesterton says, as soon as you're a wage earner, you're basically a wage slave.
But we call that liberation.
Yeah, we call it liberation. That's what the feminists called it, right? His great joke, he said, 10,000 women marched through the streets saying, "We will not be dictated to," and they went off and became stenographers. And that's, you know, the idea of going to work for someone else is not freedom. It's a form of slavery. And he says, the opposite of employment is not unemployment. The opposite of employment is independence. The free family should be, as much as possible, self-sufficient family. And, you know, craftsmen who are independent and are not beholden to the monthly paycheck, that does not translate into freedom at all. And this is really a different way of thinking for the modern world. But Chesterton is something that he promoted for his entire life, along with several of his colleagues, the idea that the family is the center of the society, so it should also be the center of economics. The word economics refers to the home anyway. Everything should be coming out from the family, not the family serving something else.
I mentioned the mystical mirror at the beginning of the podcast. I wish you could flesh that out a little bit, the significance of that mystical mirror, which has a direct impact on the concept of family.
Well, you know, first of all, he says Christianity has always been a domestic religion because it started with the Holy Family. And yet there is also the mystical reflection of the Trinity. You know, you have Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is the Trinity. The reflection of that triangle is Father, Mother, and Child. And he describes in Orthodoxy how the Trinity, which is the great mystery, the unfathomable mystery, is that God himself is a society, as it were. He means it with no disrespect or bad theology. That God is this united one. And because of it's the love of God that is the binding force of God. And it's the same thing of the family, that it's love that is the binding force of the family. And what love does is it sacrifices itself and it creates. That's what love does. It sacrifices itself and it's creative. And that's what Christ does with the church. That's what with the husband does with the wife. The result of their love is life. It's a life-giving thing. And when you think of the family in those terms, you realize, okay, this is a profound theological truth. It's not just simply biology. It's a profound theological truth, because you're not talking about just bodies. You're talking about souls. You know, bringing a child into the world is a religious act. You're bringing a new soul to give praise to God. His description of, he says every time a new baby is born, it's as if God has created a new sun and a new moon, because there's a new set of eyes looking at the same sun and the moon. But just think, creation has started all over again because there's a new soul appreciating creation. That's deeply mystical.
That's deeply mystical, and it is beautiful. When you look at the devolution of Western civilization from the perspective of Chesterton, he makes the observation that people are not usually individually convinced, but they're collectively influenced. The point being that sheep are not necessarily following a wicked shepherd as much as they're following each other. Now, that's a profound insight in and of itself.
Yeah, I remember reading that the first time, and just kind of my jaw dropping open. Said, of course, sheep follow each other. That's what they do. That's why they need a shepherd. And we are, you know, especially with the modern world, and this is Chesterton's great criticism of this commercialized society we live in, is everyone just follows each other. And that's why bad ideas get promulgated so easily.
You have a great chapter on love and sex, and you've already alluded to this, but Chesterton, as you mentioned, is committed to the sacramental idea of sex. And it is much less understood today than it was in centuries before, and probably much less than it will be in centuries that follow this century. The sacramental nature of family, of love, of sex, it is a picture of Christ and the church.
Yeah, and here's G.K. Chesterton, a man who he and his wife were unable to have children. It's probably one of the great tragedies of their own lives that they couldn't have children. And yet they knew that children are really the purpose of marriage, is to have children and create a family. And so they did basically a substitute for that by having foster children and having other people's children stay at their houses for an extended period of time, because they wanted not only the joy of children around them, but the chaos of children around them. And they had several godchildren, and it did fill their lives with other people's children once they realized they couldn't have any of their own. But for him to understand that this was the purpose of the marriage act, was to be creative. And that's what love creates, as we said before. He knew that even though he and his wife, you know, could not create life together, which is what they knew that that's what they were made to do. But boy, he really was so insightful in pointing that out in a world that was losing what the role of sex is in marriage. It just was continued to be downgraded from that time of a century ago to our place where we're experiencing it right now. But boy, did he see it coming when he was describing it 100 years ago.
He also talks about the insanity of the phrase free love.
Yeah. Yeah, it's what we said before. Freedom exists within the walls, but when you are in love, the first thing you want to do is bind yourself. You want to bind yourself to the beloved. When the young lovers, the first thing, they want to carve their initials in the tree. They want to do something permanent. They want to tie themselves together. And there's no such thing as free love. Love is about making a bond. And it's Chesterton taking a common phrase and turning it around and showing it, that's not what it is.
And that's true of so many phrases in the book. there are phrases that are discussed that they sound innocuous. They almost have a positive ring to it, like Planned Parenthood, although that's not mentioned in the book, but it has a positive ring to it. But it has a very seamy underside.
Well, birth control is the one that he talks about in the book. Yeah. Birth control, he says, there's no birth and there's no control. It's the worst phrase in the world. Yeah.
Yeah, and he also says that there's an insanity within the family when the family is so rife for disruption or fracturing or breaking apart. A person disproves of church vows, he says, and then he insists on taking them. Then he insists on breaking them. Then he insists on receiving the same blessing for breaking them as for taking them, and finally takes them all over again with the utmost sincerity or solemnity.
Yeah, that's from his book, The Superstition of Divorce, which is, he was really coming out against the easy acceptance of divorce, of making it very legal, very easy. And the ritual of divorce and remarriage. You make this eternal vow, you break the vow. Sorry, didn't mean that eternal vow. And now I'm going to make it again, still want the blessing that we, didn't live up to last time. Chesterton says that mailing a postcard and making the marriage vow are supposed to have the same romance to them, that you can't undo them after you've done it. After you've mailed that card, that's it. You've made that commitment. And the marriage vow was supposed to be the same way. And as I quoted the line earlier, if divorce is easy, then marriage becomes meaningless. It loses meaning. Marriage is supposed to be a relationship as unbreakable as any other familial relationship, as brother and sister. It's supposed to be that unbreakable.
Yeah, and this is sort of an augmentation of what you just said, but Chesterton says that a man of honor does not finally desert his family as a patriot does not finally desert his country. And I think that's a great analogy.
Yeah, that's a terrific, terrific analogy. Yeah.
There's a chapter on babies and birth control. And in that chapter, he compares eugenics with birth control. Eugenics, the science of being well-born, you think about that today and you shudder that our civilization at its highest levels embraced that for a long period of time. And it wasn't until it finally was exposed in the ghastly chambers of concentration camps that it vanished quietly into the night. Now the only thing you hear about eugenics is reparations for eugenics. But that was an idea that caught the fancy of the cultural elite. And now we have all kinds of atrocities that are catching the fancy of people who are in control. I mean, the fact that you can have top and bottom surgeries, the idea that you can change your sex, that you can decouple biological sex from gender, when your biological sex is actually stamped in every cell of your body. It's part of your DNA.
Yeah, and it's all connected to accepting a natural process that we have completely not only interfered with, but we've rejected it as being natural. Chesterton, his book on eugenics, which is quoted from heavily some excerpts in this collection, that was something that dates back to the 19th century, eugenics. In fact, the guy who came up with the word, the term, is Sir Francis Galton, who was a first cousin of Charles Darwin. And the idea was to apply the principles of evolution to human breeding so that we would breed the best possible specimen for the future in order to evolve correctly. Only certain people should be having children. And what everyone forgets about Planned Parenthood and Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, is that the primary motivation for it at the beginning was eugenics. It was not free love. It was not so that everyone could just enjoy sex without the consequences. It was really to prevent certain people from having children. She set up her birth control clinics in ethnic neighborhoods, in Black neighborhoods, in Jewish neighborhoods, and ethnic Catholic neighborhoods of the people she did not want to see having children. And it was supposed to be just her mighty white Anglo-Saxons who were supposed to be breeding. Ironically, they were the ones practicing the birth control, and they breeded their own numbers down, ironically. But that was the purpose of it. It was when it wasn't until what you mentioned with the rise of Nazi Germany, who were completely in cahoots with Planned Parenthood in terms of their philosophy and practice of eugenics, until what happened in the concentration camps was exposed, that the focus of Planned Parenthood then went to simply, we can't have poor people having babies. You know, birth control is going to prevent unwanted children. And it was a completely a different thing, but it was always about unwanted children, wasn't it?
And nobody wants to talk about this. Right? I mean, we're not just talking about Margaret Sanger. We're talking about Teddy Roosevelt. We're talking about prestigious universities like Yale and what's that?
George Bernard Shaw. You know, he was a big eugenicist. Yep. Luther Burbank. Yeah.
So I want to press this a little bit because he's making a connection between birth control and many other things, not just eugenics, but also he's making a connection between birth control and how the Romans would eat five or six luxurious meals. And the only way that they could do that is to induce vomiting. And he says real birth control is self-control. So just as the Romans couldn't practice self-control, they wanted to indulge themselves. The same thing happens with those who don't have self-control. Instead, they initiate the medical process of birth control. By the way, this, what we're talking about right now, is hugely controversial because I remember I've been doing the Bible Answer Man broadcast for almost 40 years. I used to talk about, you know, people ask me, how come you have so many children? We have 12 children, 9 natural and 3 adopted children. And people would ask me about it. And I would say, well, we believe that life is a unique category that God opens and closes the womb. But I'd always have to amend my statement by saying, look, this is our personal belief, you know. And there were a lot of people, because I said it, they start having kids. I mean, I can tell you some pretty well-known Christian leaders that have big families because their wives were listening to what I had to say about it. But it was always controversial. Why is this not controversial in your mind or Chesterton's mind? Why is real birth control sex control? And why is birth control, as Chesterton said, just a weak and wobbly and cowardly word?
Well, it's a weak and wobbly and cowardly word because you are interfering with a basic human natural act. And you are interfering basically with God's design when you're doing that. And it's, you're not being honest in what you're doing by calling it a different name. And it becomes an evil thing when you're disobeying God, really. He commanded the first couple to be fruitful. That's one of God's commands. And when we move away from God's commands, we will suffer, but we will only move away by lying to ourselves. And Chesterton points out, he says, God will not help us ignore evil. He will not help us ignore evil. He'll only give us the power to fight it.
So suppose Chesterton early on, Chesterton and his wife decided, we don't want to have any children right now, and so they start taking birth control. They didn't know that they weren't able to have children anyway. And I think that's one of the points that he makes, a subtle point he makes, the births we prevent may be the births of the best and most beautiful children, those we allow the weakest or the worst. This is a unique category, and I'm glad to read this in Chesterton. I've always believed in this. God opens and closes the womb. In our case, he mostly opened it, but it is a unique category because life is the foundation of all human civilization.
Yeah, and you're not trusting God when you say it's going to be your decision who gets born and who doesn't get born. That's not letting our trust in God be manifested at all. And, you know, it was God's will for G.K. Chesterton and his wife to not have any children. And because of that, they, you know, we are all their children now because he was able to be the great writer he was, because he would have probably been completely swept away with his children. He would have been. So it's amazing how that simple allegiance to life is what it is. It's a whole chapter in his great book, Orthodoxy, called The Flag of the World, that you have to have a loyalty to life. That's a basic human thing, a loyalty to life.
Let's get back to something we talked about earlier, communism, capitalism, and something worse. So the idea here is that the communist attacks the family, the capitalist betrays the family, and I hope you can expand on that a little bit so people can catch. When I first read this, honestly, I was a little discombobulated. But anyway, sure. The communist attacks the family, the capitalist betrays the family, and then the very astonishing vision of the Hitlerite defending the family. And the way in which Hitler did this was to make the family dependent on him and dependent on his semi-socialist state.
Right. He wanted to breed as many people as possible. That was part of his eugenics philosophy, because he thought that the Teuton, the Aryan, was the best that mankind had to offer. And he wanted as many children as possible. And, you know, you could say he was a strong family man, but he had a motive. He wanted as many German bodies as possible because they had to get rid of the inferior races. It was just very, very pragmatic, as it were. And Chesterton says, when your goal is efficiency or quote unquote progress, you don't really have a goal. Efficiency is not a goal and progress is not a goal. You have to state what your end is. And when you find out what the ends of Nazism were, you realize how evil they were.
He was arguing in some of his radio broadcasts against various people that had become popular in his day, like a Mr. Victor Newberg. And this Victor Newberg had written a letter to complain about an article Chesterton had published concerning birth control. Newberg contended that a man does not practice birth control in order to indulge his passions, but in order that his quite natural, and that's the operative word, his quite natural and therefore legitimate sexual passion may have no unforeseen and undesired results. And Chesterton takes that and he points out that not every natural desire is legitimate. Right. And he gives an example of, you know, maybe you're in a crowded theater, or I forget the exact example that he gives, but your natural inclination is get out of that theater because it's on fire. And that natural inclination is not right if you're trampling over little babies on the way out.
Right. And again, self-control is the right form of birth control. And something that just doesn't occur to the modern mind, the idea of restraint and moderation. Chesterton, you know, by pointing out this simple fruit of the Holy Spirit, which is self-control, is something that's very unpopular in the world today. Nothing about our society encourages self-control, whether it's indulgence in material possessions or in food or in some other pleasure, especially sexual pleasure. Self-control is simply not what we are encouraged to do. And you can't, you know, Chesterton just doesn't have any time for the people who says, well, it's just simply a natural desire. Yeah, we have to control our quote-unquote natural desires and show that we are actually the ones controlling them rather than them controlling us.
Yeah, well said. A chapter on parents and public education, and you did allude to this earlier on in our conversation, but the loss of parental control is in its turn due to the increase of official control. And this is surely the more natural because it is an increase of official control over parents. This is especially true to the eclipse of the father by the schoolmaster. And later on, we can talk a little bit about the role of the mother, but parents in public education, elaborate.
Yeah, I think this final two chapters of the book, Hank, are really important. I think everything we've talked about up till this point has been quite expected, what anyone would expect to hear about from a book defending the family and what makes the family important and what behaviors, you know, promote a healthy family and why the world is against those things. Everything we've said is, in a way, very expected. But these last two chapters are dealing with, I think, things that we don't think about. And as I said before, public education has probably done more to undermine the family in our society than anything else. Our children are not being taught things that their families would be teaching them, to the point that now families have given up teaching those things and are kind of just going with what the school teaches rather than trying to stand up to a school system that has become more prominent and more powerful than the family, certainly more well-funded than the family. And everything about our approach to public education is really not only anti-family, but it's anti-intellectual. Chesterton's criticism of education are very profound. It's one of the reasons why I've been involved with starting a Christian classical education, you know, high schools that the Chesterton Academies throughout the country, because our approach to education has been, as Chesterton calls, the separation of everything from everything else. We don't have an integrated way of presenting knowledge.
What about that? Expand on that. I mean, that's a profound idea in and of itself. So a mother in a home has to be a generalist.
Yes.
In the educational structure, everyone's a specialist. What's the problem with that?
Well, the problem is that what a student is learning in one class is they're not told how that connects to what they're being taught in another class. And then at another class, they don't know how these things fit together because they're only being told what the specialty of that teacher is expected to them. And there's no overall plan of how these classes are integrated with one another. And so they are only taught fragments of truth because it's within a discipline and fragments of thought. And they cannot even think a complete thought because they are so narrow in how they've been instructed. And of course, they're certainly not being taught the one truth that binds all the other truths together, which is the incarnation. If they're not taught ultimate truth, Chesterton says, they're really not being taught anything at all. They're just being taught fragments of truth, a lot of which isn't even true. And so they think in fragments, they talk in fragments, and they become very frustrated. Children, because they're not taught to be complete thinkers, and their language suffers from it, and they can't even express their own frustration. And one of his great lines, the one thing that is never taught in any of the public schools today is that there is a whole truth of things, and that in knowing it and speaking it, we are happy. There's a whole truth of things, and that in knowing it and speaking it, we are happy. So our students aren't taught the whole truth, which makes them unhappy, and they don't know how to express it. They can't speak the whole truth, which would also make them happy. So as a result, you have a lot of angry young people frustrated by the fact that they can't even express their own anger.
And the irony is we're paying more and more for less and less. I mean,
yeah, that's what we're doing. Yeah. Pay more and more for less and less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's a simple arithmetic to this. The mother will have less time with the family if she has more time with the factory or the office. Idea is the insanity of the mother, this concept. The insanity of the mother leaving her highest contribution, her highest duty, to someone else, maybe to a nanny. And then she goes off with the pretext that she's now liberated and works for a corporation. So she's giving the most important thing that she can give away to someone else for a paltry sum of money. By comparison, the sum of money is always going to be paltry.
Right, right. And, you know, people say, oh, this is Chesterton, he hates women. And no, he loves women. You know, he has an ongoing debate with the feminists because his argument with the feminists is that women have always been able to do all the things that men can do. Sometimes they've had to do them because men can't do them. Sometimes they're the ones pouring the hot oil down the walls as they're being attacked by enemies, right? They've had to fight in war at times. They've had to do things that men, for one reason or another, have not done. That's not been the problem. The problem is that there's one thing that women can do that men cannot do, and that is be a mother. Men cannot be mothers. And that is the unique thing that women have that men don't, is motherhood. And that's what the feminists were attacking, was motherhood. That was his whole argument against feminism, is that they were attacking the most feminine thing there is.
I think another interesting part of the book was the section on dangerous toys, where Chesterton talks about how we become so benighted as to think that a boy shouldn't play with a toy bow and arrow. because that could be dangerous. And he makes the extension of the argument, the logical extension to, well, if it can't have a toy bow and arrow, then we probably have to get rid of the pebbles on the beach as well.
Yeah. If you take away the toy gun, he'll pick up a stick and it'll become the toy gun right away. Yeah.
A Home and Work, the last chapter of the book, fantastic yes. chapter, and the misfortune for us to live in an age in which anything done inside the house is termed drudgery. While anything done inside an office building is called enterprise. That's another kind of misuse of words.
Yes. And while the previous chapter, the one on education, was talking so much about the role of the woman, this last chapter on work really focuses a little bit more on the role of the man, but both chapters apply to both father and mother. But in this case, when the work has become so separated from the home that they're just two different worlds, and that the modern view is that the exciting stuff is all outside the home, and that's where the action is. And Chesterton argues it's just the opposite. We start families because the place of creativity and freedom and where life is truly lived is in the home. And we take all those elements of life out of the home, we end up really destroying the family. The house has nothing happening in it anymore because we've taken all those basic things of life out of the home. We've taken death and birth out of the home. We've taken the meals out of the home. We've taken the work out of the home. And that's why you have these suburbs that are truly bedroom communities, because the only thing people do is sleep there. There's no home life anymore because they're so busy with all these other activities. And really, they're very unhappy. They're chasing after the wind, as Ecclesiastes says. Whereas the home, he says, is the place where you can have a picnic on the floor or on the roof. I surprised my wife on our 30th wedding anniversary, Hank, by serving her dinner on the roof of our house. The neighbors were out there taking pictures of us.
He really is crazy. Now,
yeah, he really is.
So here you have maybe a summation, Chester, to saying what women want is, quote, an equal right with men in business and social careers at the expense of home and family. And then the most delicious part of all of this is where he says, when all are sexless, there will be equality. There will be no more women, no more men. There will be but a fraternity, free and equal. And then the clincher, he says, the only consoling thought is that if you go down this path, it can only endure for a generation.
Right. Yeah, that's a great way of destroying yourself. And, you know, Chesterton's great book, Orthodoxy, he argues that any bad philosophy, first of all, leads to insanity. It's an insane philosophy, but it also has the seeds of its own destruction. If we keep living and keep going the direction we're going, it is self-destructive. And that's a perfect example, and hugely prophetic, too. You know, 100 years ago, he's saying, no men, no women will be sexless at a certain point, and everybody will be equal. Yeah. And what do you got? You got nothing after that, because you will have destroyed your whole species.
So what he's a master at is taking things to their logical conclusion.
Right.
And then doing it in a pithy way.
Yep, absolutely. And so he uses reason to its highest form, but he does it with humor, with wit, and you don't know how you suddenly got convinced of something. But he did it because you followed all of his arguments and you weren't aware at how well he's been doing it the whole time. He is the master of that.
One more thing. This is directly from you. At least I remember it being from you. The main point of distributism is that everything starts local. A family-run business is part of a family-run world. It's a bottom-up solution. The city's functions are secondary to the home's functions. The school is a preparation for the home, not the home being a mere dropping-off place for the school. if we take care of our families, we take care of the world. And if we have families, we have the world. That might as well have been one-upping Chesterton.
Well, I was really putting all of his great ideas together, but it did come out pretty well.
Expand on that a little bit.
Well, you know, that's one of those things, it's almost hard to expand on because it really is quite self-explanatory.
Yeah.
It's very encapsulated. But the idea of localism, Chesterton used the term distributism. It's a very misunderstood word. And so at the Chesterton Society, we're doing away with the word and replacing it with localism, which is something people can understand immediately. The idea is that you should have local control of both government and commerce, making everything immediately answerable to the folks who are affected by it the most. So if you keep commerce local, you control it. If you keep government local, you can control it. You should keep your politician close enough to kick him. And, you know, obviously we benefit from certain trades and businesses that are not close to us, but they should be the exception and not the rule. Because if we become too dependent on things far away, well, you know, we will in effect become slaves to those things and we've lost control of it. It's the principle of subsidiarity. The things that affect you most directly, you should be in control of. And so localism is a good way of understanding that. But the most local thing there is the family. That's the most local thing there is. That's where life is most closely lived. And that's the thing that affects us directly. And so whatever serves the family is a good thing. And the family should not be serving all these other things because that will weaken the position of the family.
Talk about that localism just a little bit more, because I think this is a very important concept. I would suppose you'd be against someone driving 2 hours to go to church, let's say, as opposed to finding a church in their own local community, engaging people in your own local community as opposed to neighbors being strangers.
Yeah, it is ironic how we have the best forms of communication in all of history, and yet our neighbors are strangers to us. We don't have a sense of community at all anymore. And I think if we did have a sense of community, we'd see different election results. Let's put it that way. The idea is you take care of your whole family. You also, the next thing you do is you take care of the neighbor too, because the neighbors are start to watch out for each other. And I, you know, that was the world I grew up in. All the mothers were home. The kids were playing freely between the houses. And the neighbor's mother was looking after you just as much as your own mother was, because they were in cooperation with each other. And it was a place of, you know, it was crime-free, it was carefree, and it was very healthy. And these were, you know, I lived in a very mixed neighborhood, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, and we all got along very well because it was truly family values were in every house along the street. And so localism means neighbors are actually all, they do business together and they socialize together. And the community is taking care of itself. They're not dependent on a distant government or on a distant business either.
This is a little off point, but I'd be interested in your perspective here. We're doing this podcast in the wake of the midterm elections. And I've often said that the ballot box is necessary, but it's not sufficient because our culture is ultimately influenced by many other factors, by the educational institution, by the environmental institution, by the entertainment institution, just to alliterate three institutions that impact us dramatically. So I think so often we think the cavalry's coming because there's a red wave or there's a blue wave, depending on which side of the equation you're on. But the truth of the matter is that culture is determined by many other factors.
Well, and that's the thing about localism is that we create the culture. And if we are dependent on entertainment industry to entertain us, and we are incapable of entertaining ourselves, well, there's something wrong with our culture then. We shouldn't be depending on someone else to take care of our entertainment. We shouldn't depend on anyone to tell us how to think. We should be able to do that for ourselves. And the only way we're going to change the society is at a grassroots level. And that's, again, why Chesterton's ideas on localism are so vital. There are no top-down solutions, according to Chesterton. There are really only the things that start happening locally, and they spread from there.
Talk a little bit about someone getting this book. We send it out in the mail. They get it, one of our constituents, whoever. They get this book. Give us an idea of how you would read this book. I talked about how I read this book, but I want to talk a little bit about reading to begin with, because so many people aren't involved in the discipline. And as a result, they're impoverished. Preachers are impoverished because they don't read widely. Communicators are impoverished. The importance of reading. My son, David, who put this book in my hand, I mean, he's constantly giving me another book. And oftentimes the book seems to be out of my range of interest. Until I start reading and I find out, wow, this is right in the epicenter of my interest.
Yeah, well, I think I hit upon a good formula in laying out the book with the six chapters of the importance of marriage and the things that are attacking each of the elements of the family. But the way each chapter is laid out is it starts out with a little Chesterton poem. He was a poet, among other things. But then we do the quotations, which are very much hooks to get you in, the short quotations. And if you get started with those at the beginning of any chapter, you should be hooked. You should be wanting to go. And then it gets to longer passages until you get to full-length essays. But yet, it's just six relatively short chapters, and they move along very nicely. And I think what is most astonishing about the book is that Chesterton wrote all this stuff 100 years ago. And he has completely analyzed all the enemies of the family and what we need to do to fight those enemies, what we have to affirm to keep the family as the basic unit of society, the building block of civilization.
Reading in general, sometimes I hear the maxim that for every three books you read, you ought to read one that goes back to the classics.
Yeah, and I think, well, I mean, I consider Chesterton among the classics now. I think he's a timeless writer. He absolutely will be read 100 years from now, just like he's being read 100 years after he wrote. And the thing that, you know, he wrote several important books, but Hank, he was also one of the most prolific writers who ever lived. You know, millions of words, thousands of essays, hundreds and hundreds of poems. And, you know, what we're doing with the work of the Chesterton Society is to try to create books like this, where you take a certain subject that he writes about in all of his massive prolific writings and condense it into one book so you can follow his argument, which is very consistent on one particular subject. And we'll probably be doing this with other things coming up. But it shows that this is fundamental to his thinking, and it is definitely classical thinking. You know, you could read a new book on the same subject and probably gain a lot from it, but there's some extra pizzazz that comes from Chesterton because he's one of the quote-unquote eternal poets.
Well, Dale Ahlquist, I am so happy to have had you on the Hank Unplugged podcast. You're just an engaging speaker and a great writer and foremost expert on one of the most important thinkers, as you say, 100 years ago, but for today and for 100 years from now as well. So thank you so much for your time. It's not taken for granted.
A great blessing to be with you, Hank. Thanks for inviting me. God bless you.
God bless you. And do remember, this book is a book that I want to put into your hands. You can get a copy by simply writing me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. You can also access the book on the web at equip.org. Christmas is coming up. This kind of book you want to give to other people. I mean, this is a way to give people nuggets of gold, I mean real gold, because this has not temporary value, but lasting value. Again, the book by Dale Ahlquist, it's titled The Story of the Family, G.K. Chesterton on the Only State That Creates and Loves Its Own Citizens. Again, available for anyone who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. And thank you for joining me on this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Look forward to seeing you next time with more.